CliffCentral.com. Johnny Clegg succumbed to pancreatic cancer at the age of 66 on the afternoon of the 16th of July 2019 at his family home in Johannesburg, South Africa. He was born in June 1953 in Lancashire, England. He moved to Johannesburg with his Rhodesian mother when he was just 6 years old. Johnny's exposure to Zulu migrant workers during adolescence introduced him to the culture and the music. His involvement with black musicians often saw him arrested during the apartheid era. At the age of 17, together with Sipho Mkunu, they formed their first band called Jaluka, and the rest is history. I sat down with Johnny Clegg just before his final leg of tours at the end of 2018 and had this conversation with him. Quite apart from all his achievements as a remarkable musician and human being, his ability to tell stories is unparalleled, and you'll get a little bit of that from this conversation.
This is CliffCentral.com.
Johnny Clegg, sure. 40 years in the music industry, and you've decided you're doing this big retirement tour, and it's been going really well. The final journey, an autobiographical show earlier this year, a series of legs, local and international. Less intensity than the normal punishing touring cycle. I mean, you were one of those people who used to, you'd come off the stage, you'd be more sweat on the stage than in you.
Yeah, good old days, boy.
Yeah, but...
That's why I called my first band Jaluka.
Yeah,
means
sweat.
Yeah.
Right, absolutely. Now, when you and Sipho started that all those years ago, did you have any idea, could you have had any inkling of what success might have come? Because it's really remarkable if you look back now and you see internationally the kind of effect that you had in terms of being a marketer for South Africa. Your sound is so uniquely South African. There's something so special about it. But even with all the most visionary love in the world, you couldn't have imagined all of this, right?
Not at all. I grew up in three different countries, Zimbabwe, Zambia, South Africa, and by the time I was 12, I'd been to six schools also in three different countries. I was a migrant, and my dad was English, my mom was Jewish, and when it came for me to start as an adolescent, start to construct what and who I am, it was very difficult. I didn't know my biological father was in England. I never knew him. And when I was 21, I went over and I found him. I went and dug him out. But in the period, around about, 14, 15, I was influenced deeply by my Afrikaans stepfather, Dan Pienaar, who was a crime reporter. He married my mom when I was 7, and we moved to South Africa from Zimbabwe, and he had an incredible interest in Kwela music, African culture in the townships, not the rural traditional tribal cultures, but just the crossover aspects of township life. And he was in there all the time as a crime reporter. He worked for the Star and the Rand Daily Mail, and he had a lot of contacts, my mom was a cabaret and a jazz singer, so I had a very interesting perspective on South Africa and life in general. The conversations around the dinner table were very interesting to me, and the people that he interviewed and he met were very interesting people. Lyle Watson. Mm-hmm. He was the manager of the Johannesburg Zoo. Do you understand? And we met him. I met him. I've got pictures of me 10 years old in the feeding pelicans with fish, which he organized to promote the zoo. So my dad got me into all these, meeting all these wonderful strange people. the lightning bird, not the lightning bird, sorry, Radinyoka, father of the snakes. I can't remember his name, but the book will come to me now. We'll also a chap who used to walk around with a rucksack in the bush. He was a herpetologist and also a bit of a white mystic, you know. He was also on a journey, and my father was attracted to people who were searching, who were seekers, and at times they came in for dinner, and many interesting people came
for
in and
kid,
out.
For a kid, this must have been heaven. I mean, you meet some guy who handles snakes and is running the zoo.
Yeah.
And
So, but
you never had any inkling that this is what you would be.
No. And what happened is when I discovered street guitar music when I was 14, and just kind of had that epiphany that this guitar style, what the Zulu had done, they'd taken a Western instrument and they had reconfigured it radically to the point that we had a genre of guitar music that was unique. You could never find this anywhere in the world. It was a South African genre of guitar music. And I was 14, I was learning classical Spanish guitar, and I was just blown away. There were no chords, and they had no respect for the instrument because, you know, this is like 700 years of, you know, having been developed, and the frets had been worked out, you know, the distance to create the notes, you know. That didn't matter. And they could play all their music in the first 5 frets. They didn't need the rest of the frets of the guitar, and they changed the strings around, and they tuned them differently, and they had a picking style that was absolutely unique. And I said, this is like the blues in America. This is our genre of guitar music. So I asked this chap who I met, Charlie Mzila, to teach me. And the wonderful moment was that he was in my last, he came as a guest to my last Monte Cassino show. He's 75 now.
Wow.
And
if he hadn't been there, there wouldn't have been anything.
So he was very generous and kind, and he was a flat cleaner, and he could barely speak English. He came from Msinga in Natal, and he introduced me to his community. And so I started to discover that all of the flatland, the buildings, the apartment blocks, were kind of an economic niche for these migrants. And so when somebody was let go, whatever, they'd bring in their cousin or their brother. And so there was always these little groups of families coming from, traditional Zululand and Natal. And on the weekends, on the rooftops, there would be these guitar street musicians would gather, and they would swap songs and drink, and it was just amazing. And I would be there with my little, you know, 16, 15 year old self.
But it must have been difficult to get there because of all the restrictions.
I got into
a lot of trouble.
A lot of trouble. I was arrested constantly for trespassing. I was arrested for breaking the Group Areas Act, the Separate Amenities Act. I went through all of them. I broke them one by one. But the thing then was that I suddenly had the music opened a window into another world that people were living in the rural areas. And what they did is they brought this culture into the migrant labor hostels around Johannesburg. It was like a direct import. So you could have dance teams, you could have, on a Sunday, a Saturday, the Wema Hostel, which is now the licensing department at the bottom of 6th Street. Mm-hmm. It used to house 2,000 males.
Yeah.
It was black males only, run by the municipality with their own police, which we used to call the Blackjacks, and they guarded the entry points. So it was hard to get in. But through a number of plans, I managed to get in. One of them was that the dance team would come out through the main gate and around, because there were many teams dancing outside. There was no space. There was some dancing was huge. It's died down a lot now, but 40, 50 dance teams, and they were all teams from a specific district, from a particular region, under a particular chief. and this was the homeboy group. This was your social solidarity group. You danced with them. They buried you if you were killed. They made sure when you're in hospital. So it was a voluntary association of around the district that you came from. Hmm. And there were fights between districts and dance, competitive dancing,
Sure.
So I started to learn how to stick fight and to do different dances. And I found something that it was in the dance more than anything that I found, a young adolescent male needs a strong role model, just and if he doesn't get it, he joins a gang. Mm. My stepfather left when I was 13 or 14. My mom and him divorced, and when I stumbled onto this Zulu warrior male dancing, it was a fantastic emancipation for me, and I became a very good dancer. And what, although I couldn't say it then in the language that I'm saying now, but what I was attracted to was that the Zulu male body was coded and wired to carry certain messages about masculinity. And I saw that. They'd never moved in a way that a white male moved physically. I saw that. It was another epiphany. And they were so free. Although they were oppressed in the apartheid system, when they danced, it was just an incredible emancipating activity that you got into, because you were competing against other males, and yet your body comportment and the way you held yourself, the way you entered the dance, the way you executed your moves, was a conversation. It was a way of making claims and statements about yourself, which were encouraged by your teammates if you're dancing against another team or against another guy. And so for me, it was a rite of passage into an African mode of masculinity through the dance, and it gave me an identity. And that's what I wanted to come to, is to say that this boy who had been born in England, grown up in three African countries, gone to six schools in 5 years in three different African countries. One of them, Zambia, non-racial, more black kids than whites, black teachers. Big shock for me coming out of apartheid schooling system into that, but very important and very liberating and emancipating. So when I came back, I had my head was a bit more universal than my friends at school. So the music led me into a sense of what I could be and how I could construct an identity for myself within a traditional Zulu sense of being a warrior, being a man, and exploring those things. Now, there's so many war songs, and so many, and we used to dance them, and there was a lot of gesture about real fighting. You'd kick and you'd stamp, which was delivering a blow to an enemy, or you would kick and stamp and it would be a blow against you, and you would react against your own kick and stamp and stumble back, but inside the rhythm. And you would choose these moments, and then you would make a great, this is a psychodrama going on in your head that you manufacture as you're telling a story about yourself in a difficult fighting situation, but using the dance. And all of that stuff was for me just an amazing way to become a young man. And I never went to the army, but I had really serious drill training. I danced Tuesday night, Thursday night practices, and then every weekend, 2 o'clock till 6 o'clock, formal, dancing in a team. And that's where I was arrested at Wemmer Hostel when I was 15. I was arrested by the police. They raided. They always used to raid the hostels. What would happen is, you know, I would get in with the team. They'd take me in. The guards at the gate wouldn't see me. I would be inside this dance team. They'd come out through the gate. I'd go in the middle of them, and they'd sing me in, and I'd go into the room where we were dancing, and the beds were up against the wall, and the space was made. There were 40 guys, you know, in a room that took maybe 10, five beds on each side. And we would sit on the floor, the biggest guy with his back against the wall would open his legs, and then the next guy would fit in between his legs, and the next guy and his legs, etc. And we'd sit and we'd just be very compact. And to be in the middle of these men who have fought real battles and faction fights and have had friends killed, and maybe even they have killed people in these tribal wars in the rural areas or in the city, sitting with them in this moment, singing and chanting with these deep bass songs, and it's not the smell, it's the stench of male sweat in with this music. It is the most powerful, overwhelming sense of masculinity you can imagine. And singing these songs before we dance, getting everybody worked up, because the dance leader songs are dance songs are created, and a good dance composer and dance initiator as a dance leader has to choose and build up the team, and they do that through singing. So we have what we call izinhlamvu, which are small, short, sharp call and answer, and they're all different. They all answer. Amapungo are young warriors. We're going to dance here today. Amapungo. Sizo la la la. Nani mapungo. Sizo la la la. Nani mapungo yele. Sizo la la la. Nani. So, and you can imagine these voices. You know, I'm 15, and I'm in this, and it is the most extraordinary moment for them and for me, and all of the, and I understood the lyrics and I understood the songs, and being a welcomed participant. I wasn't part of their district. I never grew up with them, but I joined their team.
You didn't ever feel like a fraud, though.
I never felt like a fraud ever, because
it doesn't sound like it. It sounds. I'm almost jealous of this, I have to tell you.
There was a guy. We all had dancing names. You have Izzy Bongo, which are praise names, and then they divided up into Ibongo Zomtsezwa. When you fight, when there are warrior names that you have, but then you also have dancing names, and then you have your general names.
Okay.
So, the wonderful thing about this is that this chap who works as a construction worker, this chap who is cleaning the floor in the flat that you live in, when he goes into that world, into the hostel, he loses his anonymous sense of self, and he is skejigile shobin. I was called Mudumlungu, which means tall white man, because I was so short. The praise names are very funny.
That's sarcastic.
Yeah. And my first Zulu name was Madlebe, big ears. So, because Charlie, when I had my school haircut, my ears used to stick out like, you know. And they're very perceptive, and they pick on, you know, your character and your personality and how you behave and how you react and things that you've done, and they make up these names for you. And so you are given names. Upiwa izibongo, you're given names. You don't make them up for yourself. And they last through time. So your praise name becomes a collection of events and situations about your own personal history. You don't need Facebook. It's actually in your praise name. And as you get on, you get more and more and more and more and more, and they're funny, and they mark off your life.
This explains a lot about how oral history is carried over. Like, it's something that very few Western white people can understand, because we used to always write things down, and we'd read accounts third hand, fourth hand, whatever it might be. But this is like you're in the moment with that person, and everything in their praise name tells you their entire history.
Yeah.
I mean, it's phenomenal.
Yes. And in their family, when they die and they become ancestors and they are called upon, you call those names. And it's the most, you know, it's not praying to a dead spirit. It's communicating with the spirit to say, I'm in trouble. You know, you were my great grandfather. And, whatever it was, you did this and you did that, and you ran away at this battle, and you also lost your way on your way to Durban, and you walked all the way to Joburg to find a job, and all of these things come up because that's the person that you're talking to. So it's important, and what I found is all young people want to be shaped and defined, to find out who they are, actually. You know, between the age of 10 and 20, you are on that journey. You're trying to find out who the heck you are. What do you really believe? And what will the world really give you? All of these deep questions, you know. And the Zulu have worked out this whole thing, you know. It's incredible. And you have stages. You're a boy, then you're a senior boy in Ngwele, you're a mfana, then you're in Ngwele, then you are a junior warrior, a bungu, then you're a warrior in Sizwa, and then you're a mnumzana, the head of a homestead, and then you become a kehla, and an elder, and then you become ixeko, which is like, you're so old, you're a living ancestor, you know. So, and they stage it. So you get a comfort knowing that you're going through the, and all the things that you feel about girls and other guys.
There's a place for you.
There's a place for you, you know. And I found that place. I was given it, and I took it, and I carried it. And when I came out of it, I realized that I was an African. This is the African part of me. This is my connection, and it is. You know, I've been, you know, doing this for a long time. So, the politics and that found me. I never did this for political reasons. I had very, very deep personal issues.
Sincere.
Yeah.
It was organic.
Yeah. I loved the culture, and it was a violent culture. I mean, I saw stuff. You know, I saw how men aggressive. Yeah. And you know,
these days a lot of that is talked down, and a lot of that is almost negated by society, and people tend to think those are negative cultural inheritance. But they're actually such an integral part of the Zulu culture that you're talking about, that it would be a great shame to lose that. It would be a great shame to abandon it in the interests of kind of modern society's rules.
Well, this is the great debate about, you know, in the men's movement in the late 80s. And there was this idea that came out. I remember reading a book called Iron John. It's a myth about reclaiming not savagery and not aggression.
Masculinity
and wildness. Yeah. The wildness.
And competitiveness.
Yeah, competitiveness and all that stuff, yeah. Yes. And how that has been bashed out of, you know, the modern man, living in Paris or New York or London.
And it must be so much worse for a Zulu man because it so defines...
Yeah.
So many things about who they are.
So, all of those things, went up to make this guy called Johnny Clegg. And to be honest, you know, I battled, you know, to integrate these things.
How did your mom allow you to kind of experience all of this?
She was a jazz singer. She was a cabaret singer. And she wanted to be Ella Fitzgerald. So when I said I wanted to be a Zulu or a Zulu guitarist, she was cool. It's amazing. And it's music, you know, and she understood that. It's only when I started getting arrested that she really got worried. When I was arrested at Wemmer Hostel, the police took me to her. And they said to her, we caught your boy inside the hostel. Now, first of all, it's illegal in terms of the Group Areas Act and whatever. But we go in there armed. These people they fight each other, they steal from each other, they bring stolen goods in there, their guns, their spears, their pangas, their weapons, and there's a lot of alcohol going on there, and, you know, anything can happen, and it does. And your son, I mean, the guy who arrested me was shocked. I was sitting right up, you know, they came into the room. These two constables, white constables. I mean, this guy must have been about 19 or 20, young, you know, in his uniform. And they came in from the sunlight into the dark room. And I, you could see that the smell of these 40 or so, you know, guys who'd been sweating for the last 4 hours. It's pungent. And they walked in, and he peered into the group, and the other guy was talking to the dance leader. And they wanted to, because next to the beds there were these little cabinets, and they wanted everyone to open up the cabinet. Whose cabinet is this? Because they don't want to open it up, and then the guy says, no, it's not my cabinet. So they wanted to get the owner and all that. And it was just, I felt it was just harassment, but, yeah. You know. But they were looking for weapons or dacha or whatever it is that they were looking for. And they used to, it was like a periodic cycle of police raids. Nobody knew when they were coming, but they would come every month, they would come in. And he peered and he looked at me, and he had a double take. He couldn't believe what he actually, you could see, he couldn't work out what he was seeing. And he looked at me and he said, are you all right? And I said, yes, I'm fine. And he said, no, you're all right now. We here. You can speak up, you know. He thought I'd been kidnapped.
Yeah.
And I said, no, I'm dancing with my Zulus here. I dance with them. And he just said, you don't have to say that. It's fine. You know, you. I said, no, I'm a dancer. I dance here with them. And all my friends, we started laughing, you know. And he said, and then he kind of, it turned, and he became aggressive. Hmm. How did you get in here? And I said, well, I snuck in. And he said, no, this is not acceptable. And he grabbed me and pulled me out, and I stood, and the team was silent. And Richard, the dance leader, said, you know, he's our dancer. He dances with us every Sunday. And the guy said, that's going to stop. That's absolutely not allowed. This is a black hostel for men. And white boys don't come in here. Women don't come in here. Indians don't come in here. Colors don't come in here. It's only for black men. Sorry. Took me out, put me in that Studebaker. They used to drive these Studebakers. I remember. And put me in there. And I sat in the car while they did their stuff. And they were quite, you know, upset about what they had discovered, and they, you know, went through all the cupboards and all the stuff, and then they came out, and then they drove around with me. They didn't know what to do with me, actually, and they said, where do you live? And I said, Yeovil, and they drove me there, and then came out, and my mom opened the door, and I was standing between these two young constables.
Uh-oh.
And then she said, look, you know, you can't do this anymore. You can't go there anymore. So what I did is I got Richard to come. He was 68 years old about. He was the chauffeur for the CEO of Metalbox, the company. So he spoke a little bit of English, and he came, and with his two assistants, and they came in, and my mom said, look, you know, I don't want my son to get arrested and break the law, you know, he's young, you know. And he said, madam, this boy is our teammate, and I can guarantee you that when he's amongst us, nothing will ever happen to him. And she said to him, that, you know, it's very good to know, but you know, you got to understand that it's against the law. And he said, I don't understand why it's against the law. We're just dancing. It was just an honest, open answer. You know, why can't I dance with somebody? You know, why would the law say I can't dance with somebody or sit with somebody or walk with somebody? You know, it was quite a powerful moment. And my mom said, no, you're right. And then he said, but you know why he's safe? I said, why? He said, I'm the only dance team in South Africa that has a white boy dancing for him. Do you think I would ever allow anything to happen to this?
That's beautiful.
So I carried on, you know, and then I was arrested at the Lady Dudley Hospital compound in Hillbrow, in a dancing there. I got praise names. I was arrested a lot for trespassing in Killarney.
So what? What? I mean, what?
And so they say, bakuzonda belungu bakuzonda efletin bakuzonda kitiga abafuna umlungu udluphuthu nabantu bakhe. That's given to me by my age mates. The white people don't like you. The caretakers, particularly in Kilani, don't like you because you eat pup with your people.
That's so beautiful. Your people, huh?
Yeah, yes. Udluphuthu nabantu bakhe.
You know, I was looking through, because there's so much material. I mean, it must make you very proud to think about all this material that you've created, all this amazing music, and the number of people who just are emotionally drawn to it. It's incredible. But I was watching.
It was an experiment. You know, I'm answering your first question.
No, no.
Did I ever have an idea of what would happen? No. To the extent that I was still making my fourth album as Jaluka, and I was still a teacher. I was still lecturing at university. So I had chosen another career. I was doing the music and being connected to my community. I was living a schizophrenic existence. I had my migrant community. I had my student and academic colleagues and fellows in that community. And then I had my normal, you know, family and my mom and et cetera. And I just moved around. And when Scatterlings got onto the top 40 in 1983, I was 4 years teaching. Everybody, including me, I had no idea, and I was writing about South African experiences. I was singing in Zulu and English, and you know, Sipa and me were experimenting with all sorts of things. And there was no airplay. There was no, you know, people were very. They said, "What is this stuff? You know, what?"
Didn't know what category
to put it in. Anyway, when Scatterlings got into the top 40 in England. The fork in the road happened. You know, I had to choose. Do I want to be an anthropologist or do I want to be a musician? You know, and I went to see the head of my department and said, you know, see ya. I'm on my way. So I've been touring and playing and recording every year since 1983. Touring, particularly touring, not recording, but you know, writing songs and keeping them. And, you know, I have a drawer full of fragments of good verses or good melodies that came up, but I couldn't turn them into anything. So every year, like 83 till the current time, I have been touring. I've never stopped touring, even through my chemotherapy, two sessions of it, basically.
God, it's horrible, huh?
You know, I managed to get out and do my work and tour. And so.
But this is a mad drive for production. I mean, it's just, it's insatiable.
Yeah.
This need to get that music out.
Yeah,
huh?
Yeah. It's
Where do you do most of your writing? Is it anywhere? Can you do it at any time?
There with a guitar? I only write under pressure. It's a terrible thing. You know, most artists dream about going to an island and sitting there and writing songs and being, you know, not having any pressure on them so that they can focus on it. For me, that's rubbish. I write on tour. I write when there's, you know, I go into a studio sometimes with a half-baked song, you know, and at the end of the day, I'm finished. I've got a real product. I have to have that. I have to have that. That sense
urgency.
And it just in a way it focuses me. I was the student who always handed in the project late.
Last minute,
yeah. And you know, that's unfortunately my
So the thing I was getting to is I was watching a bunch of these YouTube videos and things. And you know, you kind of YouTube immortalizes all of us, whether we like it or not, for good or for bad.
Yeah.
But there's the one video I watched, some 5 or 6 million views that I saw. It's that I think you were in France. You were doing a Simbonanga.
Germany.
It was Germany.
Yeah.
You're on the stage, yeah. Opening the show.
Yeah, and we were ending the show. Is this the Mandela moment?
Yeah, and he came on.
Yeah, it was the end. We were ending the
end of the show. It was just. I mean, I watched the whole thing again, and what an incredible moment in history.
It is.
First of all.
Yeah.
Because this is a guy you wrote the song about while he was still in prison.
Yeah, 11 years before he came on stage.
You were saying nobody knew what he looked like.
Yes.
Nobody knew who he'd become.
Exactly.
You know, all of that stuff. And then he comes on stage. Oh, you did know he was there.
I didn't know he was there.
You had no idea.
I didn't know. He was the keynote speaker at a conference that was 2 or 3 days long. There were NGOs, from different, social and political and economic and cultural fields and sectors, all coming together to look at Africa and come up with to help one another, because NGOs generally are regarded with suspicion by all governments. And Mandela was the keynote speaker, and we were asked to play there.
Coincidentally,
it wasn't on our tour schedule.
So you start the song, and you can hear when you start it.
Yeah.
You're telling the story like you must have done 100 times.
Yeah.
And you think, okay, well, let's sing the song, and the band are all doing their thing, and you're singing, and you could see you closing your eyes, you're getting into the moment. But you have no idea this guy's coming up.
No, I don't know. And in fact, the audience in the first chorus, there was like a, and I thought, gee, they know my song. That's incredible. You know, I must be getting airplay or something here. It was weird. And then then they started pointing in the middle of the second verse. And I knew there was something going on. I turned around, and Mandisa, my vocalist, dancer,
She
came on with him. I brought him on. And I thought, my word. For me as a songwriter, I wrote that in 1986. And then it's just so weird. My life has always been filled with irony. The person I wrote the song for came on stage and sang it with me 11 years later in a new South Africa, from a new South Africa, in a foreign country, in Frankfurt. And made this connection between me and him and validated the song for me in the most, weird way. It was just so tangential, actually, and so powerful and so true. And he was remarkable.
What did he say to you? There's this beautiful thing as you guys walk off together.
Yeah.
You know, and you had a bunch of people there in the audience, but you walked off with him.
Yes.
And then as you walked off together, he kind of gave you a hug.
Yeah. We put our arms around each other, and he said, thank you so much. It was really lucky. I didn't know that you would be able to come and perform. But when I heard, I came down to see you. I'd met him before. I met him in 91, in fact, right through that period, I met him, but they were all informal occasions. I met him on an election drive, a voters drive in Natal, and his arch enemy at that time was Buthelezi. They were both on stage together, and we did the show, and then he got up, and after our performance, he took me across, and he said, I want you to meet somebody. And it was Gacha. I'd met Gacha. I knew Gacha.
If you're a Zulu man, you would have been one of your, it's the
royal
family.
So he reintroduced me to Gacha, and we interacted. It was very funny and very charming.
How did you greet him?
I said Shange, which is his Buthelezi clan name. And he said, Foga Clegg, brother of Clegg, of the Cleggs. I did all of his 4664 concerts except for one. I think there were five internationally. And then we had this moment when he came on stage, and it was, that for me was the most intimate time and moment. And he said the most wonderful thing. He said, music makes me at peace with myself and at peace with the world.
You could see it was all such a genuine moment there was no rehearsal.
No.
There was no. You said, "Do you want to say something?"
Yes, that's right.
And he kind of grabs the mic and then he says, "Oh, all right, I'll say it."
And
then he says this beautiful thing, and I just looked at your face when he said that, and you're beaming.
Yeah, it was incredible.
Wow,
greatest moment for me as a songwriter.
Well, another great moment is to see how well your son is doing. Jesse is just a phenomenon, and he's talented beyond words, and he's producing some incredible music.
He's a very good little songwriter, and he's very careful, and he pays a lot of attention to stuff that I never do, because obviously he's in a very new industry. Mm. This is the time of the information culture and platforms, and how do you break out? How do you get known? How do you, you know, position yourself? You know, how do you brand yourself? All of these things.
There's actually very little you can advise him on.
I can't. I just say to him, dude, in the old days, we just got in a car and with the, you know, guitars and drums and trailer and speakers and went to
start playing.
Stop playing. You know, it was, and people would come because there was no TV. There was no Facebook. There was no everybody. You know, there were, what could you do on the weekends? People were pretty bored, so it was soccer, and boxing, and music. So music was huge.
Yeah.
Do you know that in 1986, six of the top selling albums were South African
in the world.
Here in South Africa.
Oh, and you mean we had
our own, yeah, in other words.
Really?
Yeah, because normally what would happen is, you know, you'd have the Commodores bringing out, and then there would be some Elton John, you know, and these would be all the number one albums, etc. And we never ever, South African albums, artists never featured. And there was such a support for local music in 1985, 86, that six of the top selling albums, not singles, albums.
You know, the country
were
so,
South Africa.
Country is so divided.
Yes.
It was such a fractious time. It was so difficult, and yet that was the time when that stuff broke through. You
Absolutely.
See, music really is
music,
like a
it's a universal
like a
thing.
Bomb, right?
It's a bomb. Yeah.
So can I ask you something about the songs?
Mm.
Because again, we can go through the discography's just massive, but there must be one or two problem children among your songs.
Always.
Now, which of those ones do you first of all, love the most? It's like the apple of your eye. And which one of them is for you just full of emotion and difficulty, and you sometimes hate it and you sometimes love it? Because as a father of songs, this is how it's going to be.
Yeah, you know, what we did is we made these crossover hybrid attempts of getting conversation between, you know, folk music and street guitar music, pop music, rock music, and they were experiments, and some of them were stillborn, and some of them we thought, you know, would work out in the recording, and they kind of didn't. You know, one of the issues was some of the Zulu street guitar walking songs were very cyclical and repetitive and boring, and then the chorus would be a Western chorus. So you had this sort of cyclical thing and then a linear thing.
Mm.
And you had to find a way to clip them together as a songwriter. And I became pretty – I knew where the problem was. I could identify in the song where, you know, there's something happening here that's not actually – there's actually two songs here in this one song, and they're not talking to each other, you know. So those were my major problems. And sometimes, you know, we just recorded that. One of my favorite successful merging songs is Tough Enough, the concertina, in that song. That's one of my best merging of cyclical with linear structure in the song. And then I learned lessons. I wrote songs about events and issues, like Mdansane, the bus boycott in Mdansane, and you know, four or five people were shot dead and whatever. So I wrote a song called On the Road to Mdansane. Mm. And it was cryptic. And it still is cryptic. I mean, if you didn't know anything about Mdansane bus boycott, you wouldn't know that. You might, you know, if you might, but actually it just
it's a bit arcane.
It was too cryptic. And when I listen to it now, I think, hey man, you know, a lesson that I learned was, if you write about an issue, the song will be dated within a year and it will lose its shelf life. What you have to do, if you want to write politically and you want to write about, you know, those issues, a strike or whatever, you have to go the other way. I wrote a song about unemployment and the workers' world called Work for All. And what you have to do is you have to universalize that specific event, find out the underlying constant cause of the issue that suddenly has come up. And that takes a lot of effort as a writer. And that's why most political songs sound like propaganda. And I learnt as a writer that I could write about politics clearly, but I couldn't. You never hear the word apartheid in my music. Mm-hmm.
You're making me think of Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, Ohio.
Yeah.
You're making me think of that.
Yes. That's. So as a songwriter, I experimented on how I could deal with that and not just become a mouthpiece for a particular trade union or political cause or whatever, because people were oppressed and we were living in an oppressive society. So it was better to look at what does oppression do. And so all I did is I wrote a song about a guy who was unemployed and he was a father. And it's his son looking at his father, trying to keep the home fires burning and trying to get on and live through, this period where his wage is a pittance and he's battling to feed his family and he's battling. But it's very personal. It's just a life story. It's a story of anybody who's going through a difficult time. Like, in a way, much later I heard the Peter Gabriel song, Don't Give Up.
Oh, wow.
A similar thing. Looking at somebody who's unemployed, but it's very political. It actually got a strong political message. So that as a writer for me, enabled my songs to last. You hear Scatlings on the radio, you hear Great Heart, you hear African Sky Blue, you hear Impy, you hear The Crossing. They've managed to not only move across the divide, which for me was the most amazing thing, because most apartheid, back in the bad old days songs have kind of remained there.
Yeah.
They have aged badly, and I've it's just been amazing for me to hear my music, being played. And it's not like, we're doing the Sunday golden oldies or whatever it is. I hear it on, modern stations from Metro to whatever. It's amazing.
Well, I think it's got to do with our identity. You mentioned how you found some of who you were in those hostels.
Yes, yes.
And I think your songs help us to figure out who we are.
Yeah. Well, I don't offer an answer, but what I show you is that it's the search, it's the seeking. And if you can identify, he's actually seeking the same thing I am. That's enough of a connection. That's enough of a message. We're actually searching for the same thing, which is, what is it to be a South African?
Mm.
What is it to feel excluded or included, or all of those things? And then just celebrating somebody else's culture or their melodies. We mixed melodies, because obviously Zulu culture as a melody, as a composer, you can recognize them, melody structures, Celtic folk music, which I was very into in the early days. We mixed melodies, we mixed rhythms. The bass guitar is played differently. It's Maskanda bass guitar. It's played absolutely differently to any other bass that you could ever hear. Yeah. So using all of those unique musical South African traditions, and they form, but they become content to the listener. Because it puts them in their place. It says, this is mine. It places me where I am. I'm in South Africa, and this is my music. And if you want to know who I am, listen to this. You know what I mean? People are like that. It's crazy. Yeah?
It does. It gives you that sense of belonging. Yeah. It's special. It's and there's huge meaning to it. It's not just melodious.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you can hum a tune.
Yeah.
But everybody knows the words.
Yes.
Even the words and languages, like in France, they don't know how to pronounce any of the Zulu words.
Absolutely.
They try. Now, do you think about posterity when you think about these
songs?
No, I don't.
I don't get wrapped up in this. And I've had millions of awards and things, but they just like moments and milestones of validation, which is great. I'm somebody who's, I don't know, bipolar. I don't know. I just have huge amounts of energy and I can't stop. And I need to get to the next day and to the next project and to the next thing and to the, you know, the next and the next, like that Foo Fighters song, you know, on to the next and on to the next and on to the next. That's me. I'm I'm glad I've been like that because, it's put me in a position. You know, I work hard. I'm an old school value. You know, I believe in hard work. I believe, you know, that you pitch up on time. You do your gig. You play your set. If it was 45, you play that 45. If it's 3 hours, you play the 3 hours. I'm that kind of guy. I have never cancelled shows. When the shows have been cancelled, it's been for either, you know, some I've lost my voice or, you know, it's been unavoidable. So, that has also stood me in good standing in the music community, in the promoting community, in the people who, you know, because. When you're on the other side and you're being promoted by a promoter, the promoter's taking the risk, and at times, you know, they behave badly, and at times musicians behave badly, and they each have got these very negative stereotypes of each other. You know what I mean? Now you're behaving like a muso, you know. Well, now you're behaving like a rip-off promoter, you know. So it's just this terrible love-hate relationships that one has. But the fact that I always pitched, I pitched at failed festivals. I would arrive.
With 20 people.
We didn't know, you know. We arrived there, 20 people, and I'd say, "Do you want me to play?" I played to 7 or 6 people in Hamburg. I said, these people have arrived. And the promoter was hugely apologetic. "I'm sorry, but, you know, you don't have to play. I'm going to pay you your money." I said, "No, this is going to be a full rehearsal of my band." And we had such a great, and these 6 people, I must tell you, and that 6 people, I believe, went out and told the story, because the next time
to
Hamburg,
a personal audience with Johnny Clegg.
Yeah, you know. I was an unknown. It was Juluka. It was an unknown.
But they would have remembered that.
Then Hamburg became a huge center for us, just because, you know, I did my side of the bargain. So one has to realize that you put out a lot of stuff, and I know there are a lot of artists who are like that, and they do put out stuff, and they don't. They don't get to where they're going. And I want to say that because of where I came from, that is, I came from a musical beginning that oppressed me, that I would, and my music wasn't played and I had to go out and fight. I have no expectations. It's very important. When you're an artist, whether you're painting a picture or sculpting, one, you're putting yourself out there. You're putting yourself at risk. You're saying to people, "Love me or reject me." First of all, ask yourself, can you take it? Are you able to take it? How thick is your skin? And how committed are you to what you want to do? That's the first thing. And the second thing is like, you know, pitch for the gig. Also, see how your work is accepted, because songs and paintings and sculptures they are all interactive things. They don't live on their own. They live because you put them out there, because that's the way you want to express or explore something. And if it doesn't connect, there's an issue. I mean, artists connect 50 years after they're dead. You know, suddenly you get, you know, wow, they say, "This guy was doing this," and, you know,
Well, you know Van Gogh.
Like Van Gogh, great. And it's wonderful to be, you know, recognized, you know, while you do the stuff, obviously. Yeah. But you know, this is a hard gig. It's a hard job. And I was worried for Jesse, and I'm worried for my son, Jaron. Mm-hmm. He's in film.
Yeah.
You know,
it's also
and
tough.
It's huge, hugely tough, you know, and, everybody's being squeezed all the time. You know, it's funny how content producers generally today are actually oppressed. You know, I think that they are just being squeezed, you know, to create stuff, and then they have to sell it, and they can't own it.
Johnny, the good news is for you and both of your boys is that if you're creative and if you are doing something, whether it's music or film or something that requires that creativity, you can never be replaced by a robot.
Yeah, oh, yes.
So all the other guys will eventually be taken away. Yeah. They'll be fine. So you arrived for this gig on time. Thank you very much. You were here 15 minutes early. So nothing has changed. You're still the pro. we're looking forward to this big shout. The final Joburg date is November the 11th.
That's right, at the Dome.
Armistice Day at the Ticket Pro Dome, where you'll perform with your friends in music, Karin Zoid, Prime Circle, DJ Kent, the Parlor Tones, among others. It's going to be incredible. You've been incredible all these years. Thank you. Please keep making stuff happen.
Thanks, Cliff.
We love you.
This is CliffCentral.com.